Good afternoon. My name is Stephanie J. Leinbach. I am a writer and editor from the mountains of central Pennsylvania. I'm glad to be here with you. We have a lot to cover. I tend to talk a little fast when I'm nervous, so I hope you can keep up with me. I hope I can keep up with myself. I never used PowerPoint before, and I'm a little nervous about it. So, if you do not, please make sure you have a handout. If you do not, just raise your hand. There will be extras up here. You can come up front and get one if you don't have one. I am married to Linford, and we have four children, ages 12 to 1, two boys and two girls. A little more about me. I love coffee and books and solitude, and I love writing, as well as anything that involves writing, thinking, talking, learning about writing. And that means I'm really glad to be here. And my thanks to the good people at CLP for making something like this possible. Now, this is not my first time up front. I've given workshops before, and I've received feedback on those workshops. And some of them have been encouraging, and some of them have said that I could smile a little more when I'm up front. Apparently I look about as sober as a judge about to pronounce a sentence. I'm not sober inside. I have a lot of emotions digging around inside me. I feel a little bit like a bottle of root beer that's been shaken too violently. But I don't think those emotions are visible on the outside, so I'm going to tell you about them. I feel friendly and interested in you, and hopeful that you will talk to me afterwards, and that I won't have to go through the supper line alone. I'm scared I will say something that I regret, because I do every year. And I'm worried that I will sound like I have all the answers, and I don't. There is so much yet that I still have to learn. But you only have my word for it that I'm feeling those emotions. There is the outside of me, which looks fairly composed, I hope. And then there is the inside of me, that three-ring emotional circus that's going on. And I can tell you about the circus, but then you have to decide if you believe me, because what you're seeing doesn't confirm with what you're hearing. But if you had lived with me for the last month and watched me pace the floor, talking myself through this workshop, and hunch over my computer, typing furiously, staring into space, muttering to myself, if you had heard my pleas to God to let me do a little good and no harm, if you had seen the expression on my face when my twitchy stomach rebelled over my breakfast, you wouldn't need me to tell you what I'm feeling. You would know. You would be able to see it acted out. Forgive me for using myself as an example, but this is the difference between telling and showing emotion. On one hand, you are told about the emotions, and you have to make a rational decision about whether you believe what you were told. On the other hand, you aren't told about the emotions, but as you analyze someone's behavior and words, you see their emotions clearly. You know them. You don't have to decide. And that's what this workshop is about. Showing or telling characters' emotions. The title is a spin-off of very familiar writing advice, show, don't tell. Now, learning how to properly show and tell is, without question, one of the most important skills for a writer of stories. Now, you will notice on the slide, which I hope you can all see clearly, the portion on your handout that needs to be filled in should be underlined, if I did my job correctly. So showing and telling affects every aspect of your story, from individual word choice to deciding which scenes to include. Today, we are focusing only on how showing and telling influences the way we portray character emotions. Showing and telling is actually much, much... Showing and telling is actually much more involved than that. We're just focusing on emotions. Before I go any further, Everything I say here has an exception. Some of these points may cause an opposing example to pop into your head, a writer that did something different than what I'm saying here, and the story works. That is the way writing is. There are no rules to story. I'm going to sound like there is, but there are no rules. There are stories that work and stories that don't, and there are principles we can pull from the stories that do work. What I'm giving here are general guidelines that, if well executed, can consistently produce good story results. An excellent writer can turn these guidelines on their head and make the story work anyway, but that doesn't invalidate the guidelines, and don't assume you're excellent. Forgive me. The exceptions do not disprove the guidelines. So, we have a choice, the title suggests, showing or telling. But before we go any further, let's talk about what it means to show and tell in creative writing. This is very vague advice. It's hard to understand. And I find that what I learned about the two basic ingredients of creative prose helped me to understand in my own writing when I'm showing and when I'm telling. The two basic ingredients of creative prose are scenes and summaries, which is the next point on your handout. Scenes consist of action and dialogue. Every story that you read has scenes and has summaries. Well, there may be a few that's all summarizing, and there may be a few that's all scenes, but generally, again, this is the general rule. They consist of action and dialogue, which is characters that are doing stuff and saying things. Scenes occur in a specific time and place. They happen in real time. They're acted out on the page. They have story consequences. It affects the story. It's not talking about what did happen. It's not talking about what might happen. It's actual things happening that alter the story. They tend to be shorter paragraphs with more white space. Scenes show. Summaries provide background information and backstory. Whoops, I'm sorry. I'm getting ahead of myself. Okay, this right here is a scene up here on the screen. It's taken from a middle grade book. You trust me, off the place with a good horse. What's to stop me from ending up in California? Pop looked up in surprise, then his brow wrinkled. Nothing, I guess, he said. Well, will you take her over for me? Sure, said Joe evenly. I'll take her over. Mom reached into her yellow teapot and handed him the necessary money in silence. But Shelley wriggled off her chair and ran around to lean against his knee. Bring me something back, Joe, she coaxed. Something nice. This is a scene. It is happening in real time. There's people talking, doing. The paragraphs are shorter. This is a scene. Now, summaries provide background information and backstory. They include character thoughts and general setting description. They sum up recurring events and compressed time. Summaries will often tell you about something that is repeated often, and you don't have to hear it blow by blow every single time. You just know that this is happening. It's summed up in a sentence or two, and it keeps moving. Literally a summary. They often have narrative commentary. This is where the author might kind of briefly appear on the page to interpret what's going on for the reader. You can hear a little bit of the writer's voice in summaries. Summaries provide context and meaning. They are often somewhat explanatory, that help to explain why the scenes matter. And visually, they tend to be larger blocks of text. Summaries tell. Now, just a quick tip. While you are all finishing writing, perhaps I gave you too much all on one page. Forgive me. If you want a better grasp of how much showing and telling you have in your story, go through your story and highlight all the summaries. Look for larger blocks of text where you're just talking, basically, and nothing's happening. This can be done by hand or on the computer, but I recommend printing it out and doing it by hand, because when you have it laid out all in front of you, now if you have a book manuscript, you're going to have a little tough time, but maybe a chapter at a time. When you have all the pages laid out in front of you, then you can see visually if you highlight with yellow. I've got a lot of yellow. That means there's actually not a lot happening in this chapter or in this story. So I would recommend cutting some of the summaries. Here is a summary. While Jane ran off to retrieve the presents from under the Greek pavilion, Rosalind tried to cheer up Jeffrey with the story of Hound throwing up on Skye's shoes. Skye and Batty helped by acting it out with Batty as Hound and Skye as herself, squishing dramatically up and down the terrace. They had him almost forgetting about Pensy and the golf clubs. For a moment, they thought he was even going to laugh when Jane arrived. This does not show us exactly, we don't know exactly what happened with Hound. It's very, very summarizing. You can see it's just one big block of text. And we don't need to know exactly what happened in it to get the gist of what's going on. Now, the advice, show, don't tell, is actually not totally correct, because stories need some telling. We need summaries. I said summaries provide context and meaning. We need summaries. And, but telling, oh, that's right, I am getting ahead of myself. Hang on. Telling happens a lot more easily, especially for beginning writers. And so that's why we are urged to show, don't tell. Now, what I'm going to do here is I'm going to go through a couple of slides, and they have excerpts from different stories in them. I want you to read them and tell me if it is a scene or a summary. I'm testing what you have learned. Is this a scene or a summary? I'm not going to read it. We don't have time. You can scan it faster than I can read it. It is a summary. Very good. How about this one? A scene? Very good. We have characters talking, acting. What about this one? It's a scene. Do you see how sometimes there's a little bit of summarizing in a scene, but it's still a scene because you've got characters talking, got things happening. It's advancing the story. Another thing is, you know, now the stage is set for the next thing to happen. So there is summarizing within scenes. This is a summary. We have a few things happening, but we don't actually see Uncle Benny catching the grasshopper. It's just telling us that it happened. It's got a little bit of action in it, but it's more summary than scene. A scene, it tends to be heavier on the dialogue. And here again, you see there's a little bit of crossover, but they usually, each section of a story tends to lean more toward a scene or more toward a summary. Okay, now, all stories need showing and telling. Back to your handout. As I said, telling comes more naturally, just kind of summarizing what happened. Generally, there are some writers who are really skilled at producing scenes and need encouragement to summarize a little more, to tell us, to provide context and meaning. But generally, telling comes easier. But emotions must be shown, not told. Now, there are different ways that emotions do sneak into the telling, and that is okay. But just in general, because telling comes easier, we need to remind ourselves to show emotions. So what do told emotions look like? What are we talking about when we talk about told emotions? We need to understand what we're not supposed to do so we know what to do. Here are some told emotions. Darla worried and fretted over the upcoming math test because she wanted to get a better grade than Linda. It's summarizing. Do you see how it's summarizing? So it's telling. We don't actually see her doing things that let us say, ah, she's worried about this, and we know why, because she wants to get a better grade. With the winter finally over, David wished to be outside instead of stuck in school. He was tired of all the studying and felt like he couldn't sit still anymore. And after she lost her baby, Felicity felt uncomfortable around other mothers and their babies. They reminded her of her grief. So these are told emotions. They're not necessarily wrong, but in a story, you want to show your emotions. That is because... Okay, there you go. You got the point. Do not do this. Told emotions rob the reader of active participation in the story. When we read a story, we are living with a character. We step into the world to learn what it's like to be them. As we read, we analyze their speech and actions and translate that into emotions. We use the same skills that we use to perceive that a friend is tired and overwhelmed or which preschooler sneaked the cookies. We analyze. We're analyzing body language is what we're doing, and speech. When the writer does the translation for the reader, when I simply tell you in my story what this character is feeling, we rob the reader of active participation. The reader is reading for the emotional experience of temporarily being someone else, and what we're doing is spoon-feeding all the information. That means she's not pulled as deeply into the story because she doesn't have to work at it. She doesn't have to assemble any pieces. It's just all being handed to her. And there is a lot more disconnect. You don't feel pulled into the story, and so you're likely to put the story down, or a little more likely. Readers want to be involved in a story. At least I do. I'm assuming all readers are like me, but maybe you're not. But I like to assemble the pieces and arrive at my own conclusions. I want to be trusted to figure the story out on my own. And a story full of told emotions feels like the writer doesn't trust me to figure out what's going on. Readers are also looking for connection. Connection is about emotion. Without emotion, there is no connection. When we read an engaging story, we transfer the emotions of the characters onto our own emotions. This is why I always cry like a baby whenever I read Where the Red Fern Grows. We feel joy with their joy, anger with their anger, guilt with their guilt, if we are pulled into the story. And the more authentically the writer can portray character emotions, the stronger the connection a reader feels to those characters. So an emotional connection makes a reader care. If a reader doesn't care, you'll lose her quickly. This is why emotions are important. Hang on. So if telling consists of summaries, showing consists of scenes. To show emotions, you need characters doing and speaking things that reveal their emotions. That's it. But if it were easy, we wouldn't have to do a workshop on it. So we are going to go through several steps on guiding you through the process of how to show emotions in your story. First of all, a little bit of backstory, so to speak. Emotions are often viewed as the opposite of facts, but without emotion, you cannot process facts. If you could feel no emotions, what would happen when you see a rattlesnake? When your baby takes his first breath? When he bully pushes another child on the playground? If you could feel nothing, when your brother calls you and wishes you a happy birthday, when a deer jumps across the road in front of your car, when the evangelist preaches a powerful message, when you and your siblings are singing "Shall We Gather at the River" beside your mother's deathbed. If you felt no emotions, none of that would have any meaning. Emotion gives everything meaning. Without emotion, you have no story, because it doesn't mean anything. Emotion explains why your characters are acting the way they do. The question is not if a tree falls in the forest and no one hears it, does it make a sound? The question is if a tree falls in the forest and no one hears, sees, or is affected by it, does it matter? It doesn't matter without emotion. We'll expand on that point and falling trees in a little bit. Showing emotion, number two, requires us to trust the reader's interpretation of character, behavior, and emotion. So you're writing a story, and you're thinking about this workshop, and you might say, well, wait a minute, Stephanie. What if the reader gets it wrong? What if the reader thinks Felicity is jealous of other mothers who have babies? She's not really. She's just grieving. Shouldn't her emotion be made clear so you don't confuse the reader? Okay, so let's expand on that example. Felicity is only grieving, but what if you don't tell the reader that? Instead, you show her behavior. You show what she's doing, and a reader thinks she's jealous. The reader got it wrong. As the story unfolds, Felicity's further actions, however they might come out, eventually reveal her grief. And the reader has a, oh, I see now moment. She flips back to reread a few scenes with new eyes and reassemble the evidence. Now it's clear that Felicity isn't jealous, but for a time the reader was wrong. This is actually exactly what you want to happen. For one thing, readers are used to guessing emotions. We do it all the time. We look at each other and we guess it. You look at me and you guess that I'm fairly composed and very serious. People don't walk around with bubbles over our heads announcing that we're sad or tired or relieved that the school year is almost over or intimidated by all these other talented writers. We don't know that. Instead, we study each other and we analyze body language and actions and words to guess at what someone is feeling. And frequently, we are very wrong. Most of the time, we don't find out how wrong we are. Readers are people who are used to guessing the emotions of others. They're used to being wrong about emotions and generally won't resent it if they are, unless you lied to them, deliberately misled them in the story by saying one thing and then another at the end. The second reason why you want readers to have an oh, I see now moment is because actually the reader sort of loves it. At least I do. Because I like figuring things out. I like to be engaged in the story. I like to be assembling the pieces. And when a missing piece all of a sudden snaps into place and totally upends my understanding of what was going on, when that happens to me as a reader, I'm thinking, wait, what just happened? I was so wrong. Wow, this is an amazing story. I thought I had it figured out, and I didn't. This writer surprised me, fooled me completely. This is such a great book. That's my reaction. Because there's surprise. It's not boring. It wasn't predictable. There's no predictability to it. Now, you need to be careful. You don't want to plant information that's too misleading or you'll get irritated readers. But the readers do like to be surprised. So we need to trust our readers. We must trust them or we will be tempted to spoon-feed them every character emotion. They will get it wrong sometimes, and that's okay. It's even what you want, so trust them to assemble the pieces. They'll get it eventually, and it will be a delight for them when they do. Okay, to better portray emotion, number three, we should broaden our definition of emotion. When I began preparing for this workshop, I was thinking of emotions as feelings. You know, those things that we women tend to feel. Happiness, sadness, guilt, fear, anger, love, you know, the opposite of facts. But emotion is actually broader than a feeling. And emotion is also a state of mind. Yes, maybe I'm splitting hairs here, but when I thought of emotions only as feelings, it kind of limited me to a list of very common ones. When I started thinking of emotion as a state of mind, more possibilities occurred to me, such as paranoia, defensiveness, hopefulness. How about you give me some more unusual emotions or states of mind? Well, I'll let you do that. Go ahead. Can you give me something more than just anger, love, joy? What is a state of mind that, or a feeling that's more unusual?
Perfectionism.
That is a state of mind.
Suspicion.
Obsession.
Caution.
What's that?
Caution.
Perplexity. When you think about something outside of the usual emotion box, it starts to actually deepen your characters. They start to become real people because these are states of mind that we have. We tend to think of feelings as fleeting, easy to change, up and down. And when we think of emotions as feeling, we can sometimes create characters who are giggling in one paragraph and in the depths of despair the next. I'm exaggerating a little, but a state of mind is not so changeable. We need to be careful that we're not shoveling random emotions onto our characters in order to make them seem realistic and interesting. A character who is emotionally up and down or as changeable as the wind can create whiplash in a reader. Totally unpredictable. Now, you want to be surprising, but you don't want to just be whipping them all around with this poor character who's all over the emotional map. When we think of emotions as a state of mind, it builds a little more stability into our characters. Because a state of mind is more of a steady condition, a way of looking at life, a filter through which all the facts must go. Now, you could have a character whose state of mind is erratic, fickle, or volatile, and that would produce the emotional ups and downs, but then you have a reason for the ups and downs. You're not just putting it in so the character seems interesting. And perhaps the whole feelings versus state of mind is kind of playing head games, but it helps me to broaden the emotional possibilities for story characters. So when you're writing, think about what your character's states of mind might be. What is the filter through which all the facts must go? Someone who goes through life in a defensive state of mind is going to behave differently from someone with a brash state of mind. We don't think of defensive and brash necessarily as emotions, but they're all connected to emotions because they create these feelings. When you create characters without considering their mental filters, you're edging up on creating cookie-cutter people with haphazard and ill-fitted emotions. It's a little bit like playing pin the tail on the donkey with their emotions. It's time for Susie to be sad, so we'll stick some sad right here. Now some happiness. And bad news, so now she's upset and afraid. But Susie has a state of mind that will shape her emotional response, and that's different from all the other characters in the story. So state of mind matters. Emotions need appropriate triggers. Emotions come from the inside, a natural response to what happens to us. Your characters will be as authentic and believable as their emotional response. This matters. The believability of your characters depends on your ability to portray their emotions accurately. But like I said, don't tack emotions onto your characters just to make them seem authentic and believable. I remember reading a story once where the characters were roaring with laughter, and I didn't even have the urge to crack a smile. Now, it might be because I'm a little slow to smile, but anyway. The story events weren't that funny to me. Emotions are a natural response to what happens to us. First something happens, and then we react. That reaction often shapes what happens next, and what happens next influences another emotional response. It's sort of like a big cycle. When we write a story with events that raise very little emotional response in the readers, we might get something like this: something big happens, and the characters are like, okay, I see, pass the salt. You know, there's just not a lot of reaction. That's shallow. It feels, if there's no depth to it. These people aren't real. Big things are happening, and they're just sitting there. But you can also create a story in which minor events cause extreme emotional responses. This is the story, like I said before, that has characters bursting into tears and howling with laughter and blowing their fuses and noses while the reader wonders what all the fuss is about. Your character's emotional responses need appropriate triggers. As an analogy, imagine your story events as a gun. Okay, you're holding a BB gun right now. It's just a small event in your story that's about to go off. You pull the trigger, boom, the whole south end of the barn explodes. That's the feeling that you get as a reader when you have a character who's just emoting all over the page. And, you know, there's no connection between the event and the emotions. It's not reasonable. OK, okay, now you got a big event in your story that's about to go off. It's a cannon. And I don't think cannons have triggers, but you light the fuse or whatever it is. Pop, it goes off like a toy gun. And that is similar to the feeling where something big happens and characters are just sitting around twiddling their thumbs or just being very, very composed. So everything in your story needs to happen in proportion. Big event, big emotional response. Small event, small emotional response. There are exceptions to this. You can have a character in a state of mind that creates an out-of-proportion response to story events. But that state of mind must not be random. It has to be created by story events or perhaps things that happen before the story. There has to be a reason why the character has a state of mind. Let me tell you a story. Let's say you have a young married woman who has a small dog. She's a Mennonite. You know the typical way Mennonites view pets. We like them, but they need to stay in their place. So if that dog gets killed on the road, we expect her owner to be a little bit sad, maybe even shed a few tears. She's a woman, after all. Because the dog was special, and she'll miss it. But we do not expect her to spend the next few days sitting around, surrounded by balled-up, soggy tissues, and lying awake at night, unable to sleep. We just don't expect it. If she does, we think she's a little strange, maybe a little unbalanced. It's just a dog. But what if we would know that 2 days before the dog was killed, her second child had been born by a C-section, and because she wasn't paying any attention to the dog had dug a hole under its fence and gotten out. And she and her husband were also in the process of selling their house to move to a new area, and she had to leave her house whenever the realtor had a showing, and this at a time when she could barely get in and out of a car. So you have a life in upheaval by both a new baby and an upcoming move. You have guilt and responsibility. If the dog hadn't been ignored, the dog wouldn't have gotten out and been killed. Major surgery, and you've got a baby crying at night. Lack of sleep. And besides, I'm bashing on women now all the time, but few women can claim emotional stability in the weeks following a new baby's arrival. So now her out-of-proportion response makes sense. A small event can sometimes be the proverbial last straw on the proverbial camel's back. And that's when you pull the trigger on the BB gun and the barn explodes. That will work if you've done a good job portraying the pileup of events and the character's strength and resilience despite everything up until this moment. The character needs to see that the emotional reaction is not just about the event, it's about everything. So, out-of-proportion responses can happen, but there needs to be a logical reason, and you need to portray them in your story. Use your own emotional experiences to fuel your character's emotions. Beginning writers, especially young ones, can sometimes despair because they haven't had much life experience. Maybe nothing exciting has happened to you, and you struggle to come up with interesting angles and unique story situations. I was once there. Felt like I didn't really have anything to say that was new and exciting. But stories aren't just an exciting plot or hugely dramatic events. Stories are ultimately about emotions. They're about the emotions that a character goes through that causes a reader to feel emotions as they read. By the time you're 16, you've had enough emotional experience to power a lifetime of stories. No, you haven't experienced everything, but you have experienced the large range of emotions that exist in human experience. These emotions are common to all of us, and even young writers can tap into the emotional lives of their characters and portray them accurately if they tap into their own life and their own emotional experience. So do not be discouraged if you are young and have not lived an exciting life. You can still write stories that have meaning because you understand emotions. You have them. Now, let me throw in a big warning here. Do not write a story in which all the conflict happens at an emotional level. You're going to end up with a story in which nothing ever happens except a character sitting around or walking around feeling and thinking. That kind of story is boring. Readers want things to happen. That's That's why they're reading. They want to see this acted out. So your job is to create a series of events that trigger an emotional reaction the character must work through, even as he solves the story problem. This is called using external conflict to fuel internal conflict. And that's a cycle, like what I was talking about. Okay, now let's get a little practical here. We're going to talk about how to actually show these emotions. So what do you need to write into your story in order to reveal emotions? Well, this is the fun part. This is easy. All you have to do is have your characters wipe away tears when they're sad, giggle when they're happy, gasp when they're surprised, and wring their hands when they're worried. You've got it. Emotion shown. Or maybe not. We show emotion through a combination of four things. Dialogue, the things they say. Physical reactions, the things they do. Internal sensations, the things they physically feel in their bodies. And mental responses, which are the things that they think. And I will explain a little later why it's important that you break these down. That you understand you can show emotions four different ways. I'll explain a little bit later why that is important to know them as four separate things. So, let's talk about talk. Dialogue. The things your characters say. So, did everyone get this? I don't want to be rushing anybody. Your characters talk all the time, so they can just talk about their feelings. Then again, characters who talk about their emotions can be kind of a lazy way to avoid having to show their emotions. Generally, we don't... Yeah, here I'm picking on women again. We women sit around and talk about our emotions sometimes. But in a story, talking about your emotions makes it possible for you to not have to show them because you are literally telling. The character is telling. It doesn't mean characters should never talk about their emotions, but talk is cheap. It's like we covered in the beginning. You can be told something or you can watch it happening. Which is more believable? Which emotions do you believe more? If you have a choice between showing a character reacting to a story event or having them tell another character about the reaction, it is often wiser to choose showing. Not always, but often. Again, there's lots of exceptions to this. This is just general guidelines. One thing for sure, never, ever have a character say something to another character only because the reader needs to know something. This creates what I call, as you know, Bob, dialogue. But Bob, when we got married 17 years ago at the little country church I had attended all my life, surrounded by our family and friends, your mother refused to wear a green dress like I had asked the ladies in our family to wear. She said it's because she hates green, but she hates me even more. I am scared of your mother. She is never like me, not from the moment you introduced us on the front porch of that beautiful old farmhouse in the valley where you grew up. Bob was there at the wedding. He did not need to be reminded of this unless a rock fell on his head and he had an amnesia. You don't want your dialogue to look like this. You want it to look something more like this. Your mother wouldn't even wear green at our wedding. Pamela sprinkled flour on the counter, liberally whitening the floor and her apron in the process. Pam, Bob slid the towel off the rod, dried his hands, and rehung the towel, straightening the uneven ends. That was almost 20 years ago. Pamela uncovered a big bowl on the counter and rolled out a ball of dough into the flour. 17 years. She hates me. Always has, from the moment we met. Her hands fluttered and jerked like startled sparrows until Bob captured them and tugged her to him. The details about the church and the dresses and the farmhouse, if they are important, they can be inserted elsewhere. You can figure out another way to do it. All those extra details was a shortcut to try to inform the reader of something. It cheats the reader out of a good scene. Now, this example has a twofold purpose. I wanted to show you how telling can sneak into your dialogue. I also wanted to show you how emotion is always present in dialogue, because emotions drive our speech. Remember, we don't feel anything. We have no reaction. We can't process anything if we have no emotions. What's behind everything that we say and do? It's emotion. Our words, our actions, have emotion behind them. We vent our emotions through words. In the second example, in this example here, there is no named emotion except for Pam's statement that Bob's mother hates her. Yet there is emotion here between the lines. Tell me, what emotions do you see here? Okay, you may say any emotion you see. There is not a right answer. What do you see?
Bob's feeling kind of uncomfortable and nervous.
Okay.
She's unforgiving.
She's unforgiving.
Intensity.
Frustration. Rejection. When your characters speak, they reveal themselves. And you just got done analyzing words and actions to come to a conclusion. A character should never have to say, "Oh, I am angry," or "That makes me so mad, sad, or glad." That emotion should be evident. So make every word of dialogue count. Delete the words that tell what should be shown. However, dialogue shouldn't reveal everything. If you try to reveal all the emotion through dialogue, you'll end up with dialogue like the first example, with everything being told. But if you keep the telling out of your dialogue, then dialogue will not be enough. You can't say everything through dialogue. Look at this example here. If you only have the words to what Bob and Pam said, you have your mother wouldn't wear green at our wedding. Pam, that was almost 20 years ago. 17 years, she hates me, always has from the moment we met. That's not quite enough. And that brings us to our next point. It is said that 93% of our communication is nonverbal. So, I got ahead of myself here. So, if we reverse that, that means that dialogue should only account for 7% of our character's communication. Now, you're not actually acting things out visually on the page in the way that we can analyze body language in person. So you are a little bit more limited. And I don't mean that literal 7%. I was just trying to demonstrate to you that we should not depend solely on our dialogue because we have these other resources.
Can you repeat that 93% of?
It is said that 93% of our communication is nonverbal. That means person to person. When I meet you and talk to you, Nancy, I'm going to be analyzing how you're acting and, you know.
And what you knew about me before.
Yep, that's true too. So there's a lot that goes into communication that's not, it's a lot more than just words. So when we analyze this example, I'm getting ahead of myself. I really am. When we analyze this example, you were looking at more than the words. You were looking at physical reactions, the things that they do. And forgive me here. Dialogue alone is not enough. Characters reveal their emotions by what they do and how they react. You know this already, but we're going to talk about it anyway. When we are writing dialogue, we know that we need to give our characters something to do while they are talking. So we put them somewhere to talk and give them a few things to do. Because we don't want to be writing he said, she said, he said, she said all the time, we create what is called action beats. And those are brief descriptions of what they are doing while they are talking. Such as Pamela sprinkled flour on the counter, liberally whitening the floor and her apron in the process. That is an action beat. When we're writing a conversation, a lot of our attention can be on the dialogue. And that means we can often overlook the potential of action beats. When we get careless with action beats, we waste the reader's time. The reader assumes that everything included on the page has some significance. If it weren't significant, you would not have put it on the page. But if you're just sticking stuff in to give them busy work, you're wasting an opportunity and you're wasting their time because they're trying to figure out what this busy work has to do with everything else that's going on. So make sure that your action beats are not just filler. And we'll cover a few more points on how to make sure you're not using filler in your story in a little bit. Okay. Action beats have immense power. The words you use to describe the actions have great influence. You can change, here's Bob and Pam again, the example that I gave you before. You can change the emotion in a scene by changing the action and the words used to describe those actions. This was fun to do. Here are Bob and Pam again. Your mother wouldn't even wear green at our wedding. Pamela thumped the bag of flour down on the counter. A cloud of white mushroomed in the air. Pam, Bob tossed the towel on the counter and retreated to the doorway. That was almost 20 years ago. Pamela swung around, rolling pin in her hand, the other pointed like a weapon at Bob's chest. 17 years, she stalked toward him. She hates me, always has from the moment we met. Do you see how this feels different? All of a sudden, we sort of feel sorry for Pamela's mother-in-law. I deliberately chose words with a military undertone to them. I wanted the feel of a battle. And like maybe this wasn't the first skirmish. Same words, different actions, completely change the story and your perception of the characters. This is so much fun. This is so much fun as a writer because you get to play games with people. I don't do that in real life. Okay. I hope not. Okay. Now, let's talk about their internal sensations. This is the things that they physically feel in their bodies. Your characters should have physical reactions to what is happening, such as rapid breathing, nausea, dizziness, headaches, numbness, sweating, breathlessness, heat rushing through the body, speechlessness. These are all internal sensations. Two things to be aware of with internal sensations. Do not overdo them. If your characters have continually churning stomachs, burning cheeks, and trembling hands, the reader will soon start laughing. If their hearts are always racing, they might go into cardiac arrest. Use a light touch with internal sensations. Too many, and you get melodrama, where it's just these characters just going through the story so breathlessly. And it just gets exhausting for the reader. Second, your story is usually told from one character's perspective or viewpoint. It can be more than one, but often it's only one. You only have access to that character's internal sensations because that character cannot look at another character and know what they are feeling inside. So limit your internal sensations to the viewpoint characters. Let's give Pamela an internal sensation. This is the battle scene. Your mother wouldn't even wear green at our wedding. Pamela thumped the bag of flour down the counter. A cloud of white mushroomed in the air. She flexed her shoulders, trying to ease the tightness that was creeping up her neck. And now we know she's very tense. In the first few examples of Bob and Pam, I kept the viewpoint distant. You did not have access to any of their internal sensations. The only thing that you saw on the page was what you could have seen if you were right there and it was happening in front of you. That was a distant viewpoint. This pulls it in closer. We now have internal access to Pam. We do not have internal access to Bob. So this story is being told from Pam's perspective. That means that everything in that story, unless you have a scene break and you switch to Bob's perspective, Everything in this portion of the story must be from Pam's perspective. Now, there is such a thing as omniscient viewpoint, but this is not a workshop on viewpoint. So I'm going to stop there. Okay, now, the fourth way we show emotions is through mental responses, also known as internal dialogue. Your characters are thinking things as they live the story. And what is true for internal sensations is also true for mental responses. You only know what the viewpoint character is thinking. That character or characters cannot know what everyone else in the story is thinking. So limit the thinking to your viewpoint character. Do not use internal dialogue. See, internal dialogue and dialogue between characters is actually very, very similar. You just have someone talking to themselves versus talking to someone else. So you can do the same thing with internal dialogue or the mental responses, what's happening inside the head, as you can with dialogue between characters. You can create an as-you-know-Bob kind of conversation inside someone's head where they're telling themselves things that they already know. How many times do you walk around telling yourself stuff you already know? Now, if you're trying to remind yourself where you put the keys, you know, I put the keys, you know, on that hook, on that, if you always forget the keys, then maybe you are walking around telling yourself where you, what you already know. But most of the time, we just know these things. So if you have a character who's constantly lecturing themselves about this or that or the other thing, it turns into, as you know, Bob, internal dialogue. I don't need to encourage you to have more thinking in your stories. If anything, it's the opposite. As an editor, one of the things that I look at when I get a story is I look at how much thinking or internal dialogue is in the story. Generally, and this is a generalization, so forgive me if you fall outside of it. The more inexperienced the writer, the more thinking her characters are doing. It's just true. My own early writing testifies to this. Writers, inexperienced writers, often lean too heavily on internal dialogue, just like dialogue between characters, to reveal what should be shown instead of told. So be careful about long-winded characters inside their heads. Your main character should be thinking. Just don't let her think too much. Keep her moving, busy, doing story-advancing things. She needs to be interesting. And honestly, when you have a character that's thinking, the story just sort of slows down. You want action on your page. So let's keep our characters thinking while they're moving, on their feet. Let's give Pamela some thoughts. Your mother wouldn't even wear green at our wedding. Pamela thumped the bag of flour down the counter. A cloud of white mushroomed in the air. She flexed her shoulders, trying to ease the tightness that was creeping up her neck. How could she explain the tiny cuts and wounds his mother had inflicted over the years? It sounded so petty when she tried to talk about them, and he would brush her words aside, as always. Now we have access to Pam's head. Not just her body, but to her head. This gives us further insight into her emotions. Do you see how each little addition kind of changed your perception of Pam? It alters the feel of the scene. This is what you can do. Four things: dialogue, physical reaction, internal sensations, and mental responses. Now, the reason why it's important to separate these four is because if we're not aware of how we're showing emotion, we can, without realizing it, lean too heavily on one or the other. Of those four, physical reactions should be used the most. Again, because you want your characters doing things. You want them doing interesting things. Put your focus on what characters are doing, even during dialogue. Dialogue between characters comes next. Use more dialogue between characters than internal dialogue. Internal dialogue is less important because it can very easily turn into telling, and we just don't sit around thinking to ourselves in complete sentences. And then internal sensations should be used the least, with a very light hand because of cardiac arrest and all that. And the other reason is because there is only a limited number of internal sensations, and it's very easy to turn them into cliches. That brings us to our next point. Did you all get that? When showing actions and reactions, we're focusing now on what your characters are doing. Avoid the trivial, predictable, and vague. So you're writing a scene. The characters have to be doing something. So we think for a little bit. I know. We'll have them walk over to a window, and they'll stare out the window while they're talking. Or, you know what? We have two people that need to be, they really need to be together for a while. So we'll put them in a car and drive them somewhere. We don't know where yet, but we'll just drive them somewhere. In other words, we're coming up with actions and reactions that have no story purpose. Unless they look out the window and see the south end of the barn explode. Then that's an important thing to include. You want them to see it. But if they are driving to, you know, help somebody rebuild a barn that exploded, put them in scenes doing story-worthy things. Don't just have them, you know, the busy work. That's the trivial. Predictable. No, I'm sorry. I'm getting ahead of myself. Back to trivial. You can't look at a small story excerpt and know if their action beats are trivial or not, because you need to see the whole story in order to see if there's significance. In Bob and Pam's case, there should be a reason why Pamela's baking bread. Maybe she dislikes making bread and isn't very good at it, and her mother-in-law always asks her to do it for Thanksgiving. You know, something like that. There needs to be a reason why they're doing that. They're not just randomly in the kitchen. Okay, we need to keep moving. Predictable actions are the ones that we see over and over, like staring out the window, looking in a mirror. Don't do that. The surprise gasp, the wipe away tears, many internal sensations can be predictable. A writer friend once told me that she was reviewing one of my stories, and she commented on all the sighing that goes on in Mennonite stories. She was commenting because I had sighing characters. Here a sigh, there a sigh, everywhere a sigh, sigh. It's bad. Let's give our characters a break and something to do besides sighing. So predictable reactions tend to be very cliched. They're groups of words. Cliches are groups of words that have lost their meaning through overuse. We don't even process sighing. We don't even, it's just there. You need to give your character something to do that's a little bit surprising, put a little bit of spice in the story, a little bit of interest. Don't make them seem trite and shallow and predictable. Non-predictable reactions take far more work to write. Push beyond what you think of first. Keep pushing. What can this character do? Just keep, you know, the first thing that pops into your mind is generally not the thing that they should be doing. And then vague reactions could suggest several different emotions. For instance, if you have clenched fists, characters clenching their fists, that could indicate frustration, anger, jealousy, or even an effort to keep from crying or something like that. Even tears can be produced by many different emotions. If you use a reaction that has a lot of different interpretations, pair it with action or dialogue that makes the action clear. We don't have time. I was going to have you give me some reactions that would be non-vague, non-predictable, and non-trivial, but we don't have time. But think about it. How would you show these emotions or states of mind in a way that is unique, in a way that is not predictable? And lastly, do not show and tell. Here's a story about literal trees falling. Our house backs up against a mountain, and our land extends up the mountain behind the house. And the other week, Linford took some of the children, including Micah, our 5-year-old, on a walk up in the woods. And while they were up there, the wind picked up, I'm talking 50 to 60 mile an hour gusts. It was very, very windy. And on their way back, they saw several trees fall, including one that fell quite close to them. And during the windy night that followed, Micah kept appearing in our bedroom, unable to sleep because a tree might fall on our house. And now he refuses to play outside if there is even a little wind. Now, I did not mention any of his emotions in that brief story, but I would guess that you probably filled in some of the emotional blanks. You imagine being five, seeing a tree fall right close by to you, and then hearing the wind at night. You imagine how that might be scary. Here's where writers frequently go wrong. We show what happens, and then we sum it up. Micah was terrified by the falling trees and worried that more might fall in the house while he was sleeping. He had been scared so badly that he couldn't play outside while it was breezy without fearing a tree would fall on him. But the reader already knew that. So even if we do show, we need to be careful to weed out the telling that still sneaks in. And that first draft telling, I think sometimes we tend to put the telling in because we're kind of figuring it out ourselves. We want to know exactly what they're feeling. And so we put the emotions on the page because we're just kind of reassuring ourselves. We're reminding ourselves. So if you need to put the telling on the page during your first draft, go ahead and do it. Just go back and take it out. And that is it. I wanted to give time for questions, but I ran out. So you can come and find me later. I would love to hear about your writing and your projects and your questions. So I welcome them. Thank you for your attention.